was that before I came to Christ, I rarely pondered the word righteous or righteousness. At best, I had a world's understanding of what righteous is, and righteous and righteousness in the world, apart from God, has to do with whether or not, say, a cause is righteous. Say, if you work for a righteous cause, then you can be considered a righteous person. But righteousness is so much more than that. It's so much more when it comes to God. Righteousness simply means a state of being right. And in this world, we're most concerned with being right, say, through laws. You want to be right according to certain laws, because that way we don't have to spend time in jail. We can be free. But that's the minimum standard of righteousness, usually, within the world. How would you like to be completely right with God and with everyone? See, because I could be righteous according to the law. I could keep the law according to the letter and still turn out to be a pretty ungodly person. And God saw that that was going to be our problem, that that's what our problem is, that's what our sinful nature did to us, is that it made us unrighteous to the core, even to the point to where we could maybe adhere to some form of external righteousness and think that that took care of the core. How'd you like to be completely right? How'd you like to exist in a state of complete righteousness and not have to worry about whether or not the standard of righteousness in which I've adopted is good enough? Because if you're righteous with God, completely righteous, that's pretty darn righteous. There's nowhere else to go after that. Jesus told a parable to those of us still living in the world, believing that a certain adherence to a certain standard, an external standard, could make us righteous. He told a parable to those who thought they were righteous and regarded others with contempt. Two men, he said, went to a temple to pray, went to the temple to pray. One a Pharisee, and I'll have to add to this, add self-righteous Pharisee, because Jesus knew very well that not every Pharisee was self-righteous. If you want a study on just that, I could do just that, but I don't have time right now. So I'm going to say a self-righteous man and another man, a sinner, goes to the temple to pray. The self-righteous man who adheres, who believes that he's righteous because of what he is, and he tells you in his very words what his definition of righteousness is. I thank you, O Lord, I'm not like that real sinner over there. I'm not a thief, I'm not a rogue, I'm not an adulterer. Hey, congratulations, you keep 3 of the 10 commandments, and you still believe that you're righteous. He presents God with his resume of righteousness. He brings God the sins that he feels he has no problem with. He needs to remind God. He has a need to remind God of how righteous he is. I'm not a thief, I'm not a rogue, I'm not an adulterer. Notice, usually the one that we might not have maybe the very first one that you and I might not have a problem keeping is murder. But he doesn't say that one. He says something about his righteousness. Jesus said he didn't go to his home righteous. You don't go to home right with God by presenting your resume, no matter how righteous you believe that it is, because the next guy, the real sinner, that's all he brings to God, is his sin. The self-righteous person hides their sin from God, hides it from each other. Don't look at me too close. But I know I may not be perfect, but I know I'm better than you. He brings God his righteousness, his poor excuse for righteousness. The sinner, all he can do is not even look up to God. He beats his chest and says, Lord, have mercy on me, the sinner. And Jesus says this, that man went to his home justified, which is the English verb, which we don't have a Greek word, we don't have an English verb for being right. So justified is an English way of saying it. Justification, justifying is to be completely right. It doesn't quite cut it, but in Greek, what he said was the verb form, if you will. In fact, he said the perfect form, the pluperfect form of the Greek word. He went to his house right, justified. And all he brought God was his what? Was his sin. He didn't hide it from him. He didn't try to make himself look good. I heard somebody point out once that the self-righteous one compares themselves to sinners. And they pick sinners who are worse than they are, by the way. They pick them on purpose. Compares to them. But the real sinner compares himself only to God. When you compare yourself only to God, we probably should not be able to lift our eyes up. At least until you've been declared righteous by Jesus and he lifts you up. Only God can take the result, the very result of our sin, and use that. That's what he uses to bring us to him. To offer this living, breathing covenant with him. He uses our sin. He doesn't use anything else. He doesn't use our obedience to the law. He doesn't use our righteous works. He uses our what? He uses our ever-present sin. And brings it to him to offer this living, breathing, walking, talking relationship. This covenant that he handed to Abram last week. So remember, God makes his covenant with Abram. What's the first thing Abram did with it? He broke it. It's the very first thing Abram does with the covenant. He breaks it by deceit and a despicable act against his own wife, all out of pure selfishness, all out of pure self-preservation. Then not only does God not call off the covenant, he takes care of Abram, blesses him like never, ever before. Right? Keeps the covenant that Abram broke. And we're reminded, he said, after Lot had separated from him, raise your eyes now, Abram. Look from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, westward. And for all the land that you see, I will give to you and your offspring for how long? Forever. And I'll make your offspring like the dust of the earth, so that if one could count the dust of the earth, your offspring can also be counted. Rise up. Walk through the length and breadth of the land, and I will give it to you. Remember what we pointed out, is that for breaking the covenant, the price for breaking the covenant was salvation. He's been saved. Pharaoh had every right to kill him. We don't know how Abram got out of Egypt alive. We don't know how he got out of there. But he not only took Pharaoh's wife that he paid for, his wife, Pharaoh's wife, because Pharaoh paid for her, he takes what Pharaoh paid for and leaves. And then Pharaoh gives him more just to get him away. He gets salvation. And now what can Abram count on now that he enters back into the land, back walking back to that altar that he built before he went to Egypt? What can he count on? It's an opportunity. It's an opportunity to walk in that covenant. It's an opportunity to live out this friendship every day. Last week, it was an introduction to Abram in the covenant. Now, what is it like to live in this covenant every day? The next parts of the covenant is God living out this promise to him and doing it while the rubber's on the road. The nuts and bolts of living in this world. To move on with the covenant. Genesis 14 now begins with the story of some kings. Four on one side. That includes, I've been pronouncing this all week and I can't get it right. I wish I could do it in Hebrew. But Kedor Lamer, was called Chad. Okay? King Chad. One side includes King Chad of Elam. And apparently he was a big deal because he's mentioned by name in this alliance. There's four on the other side. And on the other side, that includes Kings Bera and Bersha of Sodom and Gomorrah. First, King Shed declares war on that side. They win, and those kings serve him for 12 years. It says in the 13th year, they rebel. And when they rebel, King Shed actually has gotten stronger. So this time, when he defeats them, he carries their entire kingdoms off into Elam. takes all of Sodom and Gomorrah into exile, into Elam. Why does this concern Abram? Who lived in Sodom? His nephew Lot. When they split and divided, that's where Lot wanted to go. So Lot, his nephew, which is the closest thing he has to a son, is now in exile to King Chad in Elam. Abram finds out because someone escapes the battle and comes to tell him. This is a significant verse in the Abrahamic covenant. One who had escaped came and told Abram, Abram the what? Abram the Hebrew, who was living by the oaks of Mamre, the Amorite brother of Eshcol and Aner. These were allies of Abram. That word Hebrew is the first time that you see it in all of Scripture. The very first time that you see it. It's an interesting word, Hebrew, if you will. It comes in Hebrew, it's Habri. So that's where we get the word Hebrew from. It's Habri, Abram the Habri. It has several meanings in several contexts, if you will, but here's the gist of it. Normally, of the something like 350 times that this is used in the Hebrew scriptures, it's in the mouth of foreigners. It's in the mouth of other nations. It's in the mouth of people who are not Hebrews. It's their way of identifying them. And the reason being is that one of the translations that it has attached to it is that it means from across or from over. And what's interesting is that the very first ones to pronounce this word are the Philistines and then the Egyptians. You're from beyond. You're from over there. You're from beyond. So when the Egyptians say it, they say, you're from beyond the Euphrates. And if the name was pronounced on him like here, he's living in Canaan, then it means he came from beyond the Jordan. Because remember, all of these civilizations have to have one of these rivers attached to them. The Tigris, the Euphrates, the Jordan, and the Nile. If you have a land and God and your God of your land has provided it for you, that river is the reason for doing it. So what's mysterious about this Abram guy is that he comes from beyond the Euphrates, from beyond the Jordan. With me? So the Hebrew people, which will descend physically and spiritually, will now be known, at least in the eyes of foreigners, be known from the ones beyond the river. The Hebrew, the Hebrew. So it gets attached to them. Before Israel is ever founded as a nation, before we ever have Israelite, before Judah is ever found as a nation itself, before we have the word Jew or Jewish, we have Hebrew. And what's interesting is that it's the way that other people see them. It could be derogatory. It might not be. So welcome to the word Hebrew, because you're going to see it nearly 400 times in the next chapters of the Hebrew Testament, if you will, of the Hebrew Scriptures. So he comes from beyond those two rivers. So Abram's just been told that his nephew has been taken captive in this war. Where did Abram fail before? How did he break the covenant before with Pharaoh? He didn't trust him, right? Took his own plan. He didn't believe the words of the covenant, that those who curse you, God said, I will what? I will curse. So how does Abram do this time? Because King Chad is certainly cursing Abram because he took his nephew, right? So what's he going to do now? Is he going to trust that God is going to do it? How does he do that? When Abram heard this, his nephew had been taken, he led forth his trained men, born in his house, 318 of them, and went in pursuit as far as Dan. Now you think, wow, he just took it into his own hands, right? He's not trusting God. Let me ask you this. 318 troops against four nations? I think he's trusting him more than the language leads on. You know? I mean, 318, that's pretty impressive. 318 from a man who only left with his wife and a couple of servants, his father, just a few years ago. He's now got 318 at least fighting age men within his tribe, if you will, within his camp. That's pretty impressive. But an army of 318 against an army of four nations. So he pursues him as far as dead. For a single clan, that's pretty good. I think we're told the exact number, 318. Some scriptures will say 347, just a difference in the manuscripts themselves. But I think we're told the exact number just to hear how ludicrous this sounds. 300 men against four nations. And it said, for this reason, he divided his forces against them by night, he and his servants. Routed them, pursued them to Obah, north of Damascus. Then he brought back all the goods and also brought back his nephew Lot with his goods, women, and the people. He just marched in and left. He just did it. He just absolutely did it. So what happened? Did he trust God to pull this off? He did. And what did God do? He blessed him. God cursed those who cursed Abram by carrying off his nephew. And then he did what? Then he blessed them with all the spoils that would come if he just defeated four nations. All the goods he brings back with him. And if you don't buy it on face value right there, there's a way that the covenant tells you that it was by God in the next verses. After his return from the defeat of King Chad and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Shaveh, that is, the king's valley. And King what? King Melchizedek of Salem brought out bread and wine. He was a priest of who? Of the God Most High. If you're doubting just from the language that God was the one that pulled this off, this guy showing up should go beyond all doubt. This guy comes out of nowhere. This Melchizedek comes out of nowhere. And it says, he was a priest of God Most High. He blessed him and said, blessed be Abram by God Most High, maker of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand, Abram. And Abram then gave him what? Gave him one-tenth of everything. By the way, it's the very first time you see anybody pay their tithe. Abram, out of his gratitude to God, pays his tithe to this priest. Notice, he carries God's blessing, which makes him priest of the Most High. But being from Salem, we don't know anything else about him. That's it. He just shows up out of nowhere. These words are never mentioned. The name Melchizedek is only mentioned twice in all the Bible. In all the Hebrew Bible. The author of Hebrews in the Greek scriptures is going to mention Melchizedek quite a few times. But it's only mentioned twice. Here in Psalm 110. And that's what's so special about him. That's what Hebrews says is so special about him. Why so sudden? Why out of nowhere? He does. He literally comes out of nowhere. Speaking God's blessings. Referring to God as God what? God Most High. Claiming to have this blessing from God Most High. Claiming to have the authority to give it to Abram. Up until this time, the only person blessing Abram is God himself. And this priest out of nowhere is now blessing, giving Abram the same blessing. Hebrews says that's what was special about him. This Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the God Most High, met Abraham as he was returning from defeating the kings and blessed him. And to him, Abraham apportioned one-tenth of everything. His name in the first place means King of Righteousness. Melchizedek. Zedek in Hebrew is righteous. Melchi, King of Righteousness. It's literally what his name means. So the blessing that he brings is what? It's righteousness. This was a righteous cause, Abram. You trusted me, Abram. And now he gets what pronounced upon him from the king of righteousness. He's also the king of Salem, that is, king of peace. So even the nation that he's from. So again, no human origin. The author of Hebrews saying that Jesus' priesthood then is along these lines when he goes on to say this, when he goes on to do it. Without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but resembling the Son of God, he, the Son of God, remains a priest. How long? So when the author of Hebrews says, you want to know what Christ's priesthood is like? It's not like being one of genealogy. He doesn't come from the genealogy of Aaron. He isn't a Levite. Jesus wasn't. He said his lineage of priesthood comes from Melchizedek. No genealogy. In other words, once, always, and one, and forever. That's what's special about him. Tzedek is my king. Tzedekah, righteousness, is my king. This is what his name. In the kingdom itself, Salem, is from the word shalem. Anybody recognize that? It's from the word peace, shalom. It means completeness, a covenant of peace, a sacrifice for alliance, a friendship, safe, at peace. Eventually will become the place that will symbolize all of this. Jerusalem. So God sends him a priest, but not just any priest. King of righteousness priest. A forever priest. Maybe the priest isn't forever. I'm not claiming that Melchizedek himself is immortal. But the blessing that he pronounces is what? Is righteousness. And righteousness for how long? Forever. So he sends him this king and this priest. He sends him embodied righteousness. He sends him righteousness incarnate. Where does that sound familiar? In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was God. And the Word was with God. And the Word became flesh and walked among us. But not just that. Not just that. Pure blessing. That God keeps his covenant in this way. Look at Abram himself. Has he grown since Pharaoh? Has he grown just a little since Egypt? He won't take any reward. The king of Sodom tried to give it to him. It's all yours. He refused it. He says, no, I won't take any reward. I'll owe all of this to God. This all belongs to God. I will take none of it, but I will give a tenth to this priest of God, to this king of God. That's what I'll give to him. So the man who accepted a bride price for his own wife out of fear and lack of faith will not take that which really belongs to him. And he's decided he owes it all to him. He owes it all to God. He takes nothing. He doesn't even take credit for being noble. And I can't help but notice, he doesn't take any credit for paying his tithe either. I know I didn't read the parable, but the self-righteous one prayed. He said, I'm not a thief, I'm not a rogue, I'm not an adulterer. I pay my tithe, and I fast twice a week. The first guy to pay tithe doesn't even acknowledge that he paid tithe. And we wouldn't have known. Moses told us. Abram now knows that this covenant is not about him. It's about him. It's about him. It's about God. He is the covenant. Or at least he's on that path. Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have sworn to God Most High, maker of heaven. So I want you to see a pattern in this covenant with Abram, the Abrahamic covenant, if you will. First thing, God speaks with him. Remember, he's just living his life. He's worshiping. He's a pagan, along with his brothers and his father, living in Haran. These pagans are just worshiping other gods, pagan gods, and all of a sudden it said that God came to him. He speaks to him out of nowhere. So the first thing God does is speak to him. Next, as the covenant moves along, he sends him an actual physical presence of himself. This priest, this king, named the righteousness of God, the king of God's righteousness, if you will, the king of God's peace. He sends him a physical presence, then, if you will. First, it was a voice. Now, it's a presence. So what comes next? What's next in this covenant with Abram? It says that after these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a what? In a vision. Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield. Your reward will be very great. So now he appears to him, not quite face to face, but it isn't a representative. It's who? It's him. But he needs to come to him in a dream. So God comes to Abram to reveal what? To reveal more. You've met me here with your trust and your faith. I'm now going to take you to the next point of faith that I need you to come to, that I want you to come to. What happens next to me, what happens next to me is what the covenant is all about. If you're going to have a walking, talking God who wants a walking, talking relationship with you, then guess what? You really get to talk when you need to. And I believe that this is what the Abraham covenant is all about, is what happens next. Abram says, after all this, oh, Lord God, what will you want? What will you give me? He has walked away from the riches of Sodom and Gomorrah and King Chad. What will you want? What will you give me? For I continue. Now, he's not asking for any of those things. He's pointing out to God that the promise of the covenant was that he was going to have what? Children. How many? Count the grains of sand. Amen. Abram does next, with everything that he's had, he looks God right in the eye and says, no kids, exalted father, is childless. And the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus. And Abram said, you've given me no offspring, so a slave born in my house is going to be my heir. Any of you talk to God that way? Whether or not you feel that you should. Okay? Isn't the reason that I bring it up? Abram, who right now is closer to God than anybody at this particular time, I have to trust that Abram was chosen again because he would be at least be the only one that listened. He receives all the riches, and he receives God's perfect righteousness of the covenant. And the one thing that he does is look God in the eye and say, you have not come through yet. I'm just reminding you of that. Exalted Father, the joke's still on me. I'm tired of picking up the sand and letting it go through my fingers trying to count grains. That worked a month ago. I'm tired of it now. What gives, Lord? Man. What would you and I do if we were God? I think Abram's just lucky that no one else is God but God. Amen. Okay. Fortunately, we're not. So how does God answer? Sand. Okay, I promised you sand. How about now? How about I reword the promise for you? The word of the Lord came to him, this man shall not be your heir. No one but your very own issue shall be your heir. And he brings him outside and said, look toward the heaven and count the stars if you're able to count them. Then he said, so shall your descendants be. Wow. You're getting ready for God to say, you know what? For you to be this ungrateful at this point in time in the covenant, you know what? I've had it. I should have called your brother. God, without missing a beat, without saying anything, reiterates the covenant itself, but puts it in a new language that maybe, hopefully, refreshes it with Abram. What I'm saying is this. Only a friend can ask the questions that Abram has just asked. Only a friend can treat another friend this way. God once again comes back and he rewards this friendship. He rewards the honesty, something only a friend can do coming back. A servant will not question. He has no right to. A friend, on the other hand, is what? He's expected to. He's expected to call his friend on the carpet when he has not come through. He's expected to point out broken promises. And friends are supposed to be able to hear that from friends. This covenant is with God. This is what he's been looking for. This is what he wants from his children ever since they turned their back on him. Trust him. Friendship is what he seeks. And I love that he gives them this fresh new take on who God is. It's not count the sand anymore. It's not count down here. It's count what? It's count the stars. I'm not just the God of earth. I'm the God of heaven. I'm the God of the cosmos. You thought that the covenant ended with the earth? No. Look. And apparently, it works. Because the next words that Moses said is that Abraham won. He believes again. He believes the Lord. And the Lord reckoned to him as what? As righteous. Might be, if you held a gun to my head and said immediately, right now, pick your favorite verse. What happens? Look at the steps of the covenant itself. Look what happens when you trust God as a friend trusts each other, as friends trust each other. Reckoned as righteous. It's not Abram's actions that make him righteous. It's up to God to reckon, to treat us, and to make us righteous. Remember, he calls something out of nothing. He refers to Abram as exalted father, even though he has no children. God can do that. When you're the creator of all the stars in the cosmos, you can call something whatever you want to call it. To be reckoned righteous by faith rather than by my resume. Because we all don't need to be reminded of our resumes, do we? Are they perfect? Absolutely spotless? Is Abram's perfect? No. So all God asks is, do you trust me with your resume? Wait a minute, Lord. My resume is nowhere near righteous. How about if I call you righteous? You trust me with my righteousness. It's my righteousness. I can do what I want with it. And if I want to give it to you, and if I want to call you righteous, then I will do so. And that's what he's doing here. Abram believes, and God says, all I need is that right there. That's all it's based on. By faith. That's all it was ever based on, by the way. That's Paul's argument in Romans. Paul said, when I was Saul, I used to think it was based on my resume. It was based on my performance. So he had no problem going to God every day, reminding him that he was circumcised on the eighth day, that he was born of the tribe of Benjamin. Pharisee of Pharisees, as unto the law, perfect. He reminded everybody that he ever saw. And he reminded God of it too. Until one day he meets Jesus, and he sees righteousness right in front of him. And he knows his resume falls way short. Jesus says, if you just believe in me. So God's righteousness is not earned by obedience to the covenant either, by the way. Was Abram completely obedient to the covenant? No, he was not. So we're reminded of that. How then was it reckoned to him? Paul says, was it before or after he'd been circumcised? In other words, was he pronounced righteous because he did what God told him to do? He circumcised himself, that becomes the seal of the covenant. He says, was he reckoned as righteous before or after his obedience? Before or after his circumcision? It was not after, but it was what? It was before. He treated him as righteous before he ever acted in righteousness. He received the sign of circumcision as a seal of the righteousness that he had by faith while he was still what? while he was still uncircumcised. The purpose was to make him the ancestor of all who believe, not just the ancestors of those who've been circumcised, but the ancestors of everyone who would have what? Everyone who would have faith. And thus righteousness can be reckoned to them. This is what makes us children of Abraham. Is it true that only children of Abraham are saved? Yes. Every rabbi that ever taught that, it's true. It's right. Paul still says the only way you can be saved is to be a child of Abraham. This is what makes us children of Abraham. Not whether or not we descended from Isaac, not whether or not we have Isaac's DNA in us, not whether or not we've been circumcised. Ladies, I don't know how you're left out of that part of the covenant. Salvation is yours. The covenant is yours. Thanks to Jesus, we are all children of Abraham. So now Abraham's considered not only the keeper of the covenant, now he's considered what before God? Right. Righteous. He has a right to stand before God and say, don't look at my resume anymore. And God, his infinite love, probably actually looked at Abram and said, what resume? So it seems to calm him down. Now that he's right before God, is Abram now just going to settle into this perfect obedience? God said it, I believe it, that's good enough for me sort of thing? Is it going to be that kind of relationship? Look what he did next. But he said, oh Lord, how am I to what? How am I to know? Are you kidding me? It appears the righter you are with God, the deeper the friendship can go. You can't buy this. You can't earn this. God gives this. He craves it. He wants this. God just doesn't make us right so that we would take what we think we deserve and just shut up and be satisfied. He says, you deserve nothing but death, y'all. Now come to me and drink from the fountain of life. Come, let us reason together. Let's wrestle this out if we have to. How long, Lord? Let's wrestle forever. That's what I want from you. How do I know this for certain? Notice, in this whole interchange, God does not rebuke Abram for lack of faith, doesn't rebuke him for his stubbornness or his selfishness. He simply answers him with what? With the words and the blessings of the covenant. That's all he keeps bringing back to him. In this particular case, he says, okay, I'll answer you one more time. I will admit, it seems to be a very strange way to answer, but I want you to kind of come with me a little bit on this. It isn't strange to Abram. Whatever God is about to ask him to do, Abram is very aware of what he's doing when he does it. So there's information that we don't have. Okay? So I'm just going to warn you about that now. So he says to him, bring me a heifer. What's a heifer? A full-grown what? Full-grown cow. 3 years old. A female goat. So we go from this to this, right? A ram. Probably about the same size. A turtle dove and a young pigeon. Notice, he just said what? Bring them. Here's why I know that Abram knows something that we don't. Because Abram just doesn't bring them. He brings them all, and he does what with them? He cuts them in two, laying each other over against each other. So he cuts them in two, and he lays the halves like this. But he didn't cut the birds in two. Not 100% sure. So did God tell them to cut them open? No. So Abram knows exactly what God is asking him to do. It's just that we don't do it. We don't understand this. Whatever he has in mind, Abram carries it out. We may know now They've uncovered these ancient suzerain treaties, the Hittites. And the Hittites, the suzerain treaty were a series of ways that ancient kings, between kings and subordinates, that they would enter into these covenants, if you will. And at least in some of them, this ceremony is performed. So it has something to do with kings and subordinates. See, Abram thinks he knows what God wants. And in fact, Abram knows, he knows in his head what God wants. God doesn't have to explain to him what he do. So he understands what a king would be asking me to do. This is what Pharaoh should have asked him to do if he was going to stay. This is what he would ask him to do. So imagine all of these animals. Can you imagine the scene? Can you imagine the blood? Can you imagine all just laying there? It's what he knows. It's what he knows. It's what he thinks God is asking you to do. So, of course, when you do that, what's going to show up? Birds of prey. So they come down to the carcasses, and what does Abram do? He spends all day driving them away. And then, as the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and a deep one, a deep and terrifying darkness descends upon him. See, we think we know. We don't know. Abram thinks he knows what God is asking for. A great and terrifying darkness. See, the suzerain treaty, some of them ended this way, between the king and the subordinate. I'm going to live in your nation. Okay, I'm going to live in your nation, and I'm always going to be loyal to you. I'm not here. I'm only here to just because I got nowhere else to go. I'm only here if you could, I'll pay my taxes. I'll do all of these things. I'm going to live the way the king would have me live, or else. And they would perform this, or else. And what the subordinate was supposed to do, what the one from beyond the river was supposed to do, was to walk in between carcasses, saying, if I betray you, this is what will be done to me. Abram thinks he knows what God wants. God is waiting for him. That's why it takes all day. He believes that God is waiting for him to do that. To say, if I violate my covenant with you, my king, this is what you can do to me. And it explains the terror. Why? Because Abram has already violated the covenant. And he knows it. Those words in Hebrew weren't there. A great, terrifying darkness descended upon him. He just invoked dismemberment as the punishment for breaking the covenant. And he's terrified because he knew that he already would. That he's already broken it. And he really believes at that moment this is what God is waiting for. I shouldn't have been so insolent to him. I shouldn't have been so ungrateful to him. How many of us remember the first time that God pointed out our sin to us? How many here first remember the first time that they realized that they really were a sinner? Remember the terror? Just for that moment. Because if you're already a sinner, where else do you have to go? We can go the route of the self-righteous and try to cover it up. Or we could just take the punishment that's coming to me. On the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. The covenant must be kept one way or another. He deserves what anyone who broke a covenant with a human king. He deserves death, maybe even dismemberment. In Abram's mind, God is just waiting like a king would wait for you to now complete the agreement. He's been trying to avoid this all day. That's why he's keeping the birds of prey away. Night seems to be the deadline. Time has now won. It's now run out. He has to face this. He has to face his punishment. And then the most beautiful thing happens within the darkness. Remember, the Hebrew in it describes it as a great, terrifying, deep darkness. But from the darkness, he hears something. He hears a voice. And the Lord said to Abram, know this for certain, offspring shall be aliens in a land that is not theirs, shall be slaves there, they will be oppressed for 400 years, but I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterward they shall come out with great wealth, with great possessions. As for you yourself, you shall go to your ancestors in peace, you shall be buried in a good old age, and they shall come back here in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. Children, curse the nation that enslaves those children. Promise him he lives to old age. What did God just do for you? Without Abram getting up and taking any punishment, he just gave him what? He gave him the covenant. And if Abram standing there still confused, what happens next is unbelievable. The sun had gone down and it was dark, so now it's completely dark. I believe that God waited. He waited for this. He waited to bring this out in his new son of righteousness. He waited to bring this out for you, his son of faith. It was dark. A smoking fire pot and a flaming torch passed between these pieces. Smoking fire, this Hebrew word is one word. It could be translated, mostly it's translated smoking fire pot or oven. It can be an oven that is built into a home, and it can also be a portable oven. See, Abram's not, he doesn't have land, he doesn't have a house. So I think that smoking fire pot is good here. It's a little portable oven that you used in the wilderness to bake your bread. That's what it was for. The grain offerings that come when the temple is, actually when the sanctuary is put up, the grain offerings that God wanted presented, they're to come from the oven. You're supposed to roast your grain before you offer it. So it was done in these ovens. The word is used like 265 times. This is the very first time that it's used. So it provides portable bread. Also, the word symbolically comes to know prophetically as the heat of judgment. This oven carries the heat of judgment. As a matter of fact, when they build Jerusalem, there is a tower there called the Tower of Ovens or the Tower of Furnaces. I think it's where trials took place and the heat of judgment is felt in there. So either way, it has all to do with sacrifice. It has to do with bread in the wilderness. God says, I'm going to take care of you. You and your portable oven, because you come from beyond. You're going to have one. Sitting in right now is light. And he is the light who has come into the world. And when he came into the world, the darkness had no chance. God keeps the covenant by not only giving it, but also saying, if you break it, and you have it, I also will pay the price. God keeps the covenant by paying the price for breaking it. It's our price, what we deserve. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants I give this land. Those descendants, by the way, they'll get to put away their smoking fire pots, and they'll get to build an oven on them in the land that they will remain forever. So maybe more accurately, he doesn't keep the covenant. He keeps remaking it. He keeps making it brand new. So I want you to notice, real quick, this is the Abrahamic covenant so far. First, God speaks to Abram. Gives him the covenant. First thing Abram does is what? Is break it. Abram speaks back. He calls on the name of the Lord after he breaks the covenant in Egypt. He goes all the way back to the Oaks of Mamre, back to where he first built that altar, and calls on the name of the Lord. He comes back and says, yeah, guess what, Father? I think I messed up. Abram believes God, and God gives an opportunity to try this new belief out with King Chad and the four other kings, and he tries it out, and it works out for him, right?
And then God sends him this mysterious priestly king. He sends him some sort of physical manifestation that he is actually there. What is he gearing Abram up for? I want to tell you that the next time that Abram and God communicate, guess what? God shows up face to face. What is he gearing him up for? First it's voice, then it's a dream. Now it's this priest and king. The next time we see him, Abram will be sitting at the entrance to his tent, and he'll look up. And three men, it appears, will be walking towards him. And then God comes to Abram in these symbols of light, in the symbols of his covenant, the sustenance to be taken care of in the wilderness, and the light to show his way. This is what it looks like so far. He personally pays the price each time the covenant is broken. He gives Abram the whole reward of the covenant over and over again. This is the second time that he's done it. I want you to notice the next, like I said, the next two encounters, he will be face to face. So for those of us living today, for you and me, are we still partakers of the Abrahamic covenant? If we're children of Abraham, if we're sons and daughters of Abraham, are we still the partakers of the covenant? Of course we are. Because as this says right here, first, as God speaks to Abram, he speaks to us today, our Father. Long ago, God spoke to our ancestors in many and various ways by the prophets and by the patriarchs, by the way. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by what? By his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, whom he also created also the worlds. So he speaks to us the covenant. He brings us the covenant that our forever high priest brings us. Why? Because what have we done with the covenant? We've broken it. If we're reminded of how we broke it. Romans 3:10, as it is written, there is no one righteous, not even one. How many? How many here are righteous? None. There is no one who has understanding. There is no one who seeks God. All have turned aside together. They've become worthless. There is no one who shows kindness. There is not even one. Their throats are opened graves. They use their tongues to deceive. The venom of vipers is under their lips. Their mouths are full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Ruin and misery are in their path, and the way of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. So just in case we wanted to look at our neighbor John and say, I mean, I'd be perfect, Lord, but I'm a whole lot better than that guy. We realize we've broken the covenant, so we go to him. And when, 2 verses later after that discourse right there, 2 verses, God, Paul pronounces the most beautiful words to anybody reading Scriptures in Romans. Everybody stands before God condemned. Everybody. And then he says, but now the righteousness of God is revealed here and now to everybody who realizes that that was them he was just talking about. So we go to God. And God sends us his assurance in this intercessor again. Therefore, we have a great one, a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God. Let us hold fast to our confession. We don't have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but we have one in every respect has been tested as we are, yet without what? Without sin. Let us therefore approach the throne of grace with boldness. Pretty bold for Abram to walk right back into God's presence, go right back to his altar at Bethel. Was it pretty bold after what he had just pulled in Egypt? Was it pretty bold to walk up to that altar and call on the name of the Lord? Was it bold of him to ask for even more after the covenant had been given to him back again? Was it bold of him to be so ungrateful and say, you know what, you haven't come through yet? Getting a little tired of living off the promise. I need to see the promise. And by the way, that won't happen for another 20 years. Pays the price for allow sin to be what? To be sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God.
Gives us the reward of his righteousness. Gives us the reward for keeping the covenant even though we broke it. When Christ came as high priest of the good things that have come, then through the greater and more perfect tent, not made with hands, out of this creation, the sanctuary where? The perfect. Him, he is that sanctuary in heaven. He entered how many times? Once for all in the holy place, not with the blood of goats and calves, but with his own blood, thus obtaining one redemption. It's beautiful, isn't it? It's barely believable.
I think we do the Abrahamic covenant a disservice by calling this the new covenant, when actually it's the Abrahamic covenant all along.
So when we get to old and new, and by the way, a study of the covenant, we're going to talk about the so-called new covenant, and we're going to find out, or at least just been proven here, that it's not so new. Amen. God is once, always, and what? Forever. Barely believable. Yet there are those of us who have trouble with this beauty right here. They have trouble. Who is it that has trouble with this? The sinner? No. The sinner has no trouble with this. Who is it that has trouble with this? Those of us who claim not to be sinners because we keep three of the Ten Commandments. I'll add four. We'll add Sabbath to that, and we're better than that guy, right? I thank you, O Lord. I'm not like that self-righteous Pharisee. He only keeps three of the commandments. I keep four of them. We have the trouble. So if we have the trouble, what do we do? Where do we go? He brought him outside and said, look toward the heaven and count the stars if you're able to count them. Galatians says, just as Abraham believed God and it was reckoned to him as righteousness, so you see those who believe are what? Are the descendants of Abraham. We take our self-righteousness, we take everything that we've ever done, we take our selfish nature, we take every victory that we've given the devil, we take every one of them right now, and we do what he told Abraham to do. Go outside and what? Come to me and count the stars. Look towards heaven. He said, look towards heaven. It's all yours. All we need to do is what? All we need to do is believe. And Abram believed, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. Might be my favorite part of the entire Abrahamic covenant. But we're not done, because God's not done with the covenant yet either. We've got quite a bit ways to go with our Father of righteousness, with our Father of righteousness.